Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening.
And hear the same sad echo when you walk.
Consequences, the ripples echoing from events, some sad from long ago. From Moscow to the center of the universe, the history of everything this hour, history that is still with us. Cold wars, hot singularities, and big bangs. We literally will be listening for signs of energy from the first moments of the universe. Hear anything? Well, we will talk with someone who can hear the faint echoes from 14 billion years ago. Also, how Vladimir Putin is rippling the pond of history with his annexation of Crimea from Ukraine. How you can apparently drop a Boeing 777 into a smooth pond without a ripple. The search for Flight 370 continues. And the power of Bruce Lee still with us everywhere in entertainment and pop culture, whether you remember him or not. But first, laughing at the West. In the middle of the crisis in Ukraine, Russian leader Vladimir Putin last week clearly signaled through an interpreter that he had no patience for any criticism by the West and the United States.
We are often accused of being illegitimate in what we do. And when I ask them, do you think that everything you do is legitimate? They say yes. Well, I can tell you, let's remember what the U.S. did in Afghanistan, in Iraq, in Libya.
Rhetoric from Vladimir Putin eagerly picked up by sympathetic Russians, from TV announcers in Moscow reminding the U.S. this week of Russia's still potent nuclear capability, to Russians in Crimea shouting to the world yesterday that Mother Russia is back and the U.S. better pay attention.
I think Americans are thinking that Russia is on the level of 1991, a country you can use as a doormat. Russia's not like that. It's a country that's starting to dominate the world, and Americans should understand that. They are slowly dying, their economy and democracy.
If reports of the death of the U.S. economy and American democracy are a bit premature, the reach of the U.S. and Western governments seems to have some limits. What territory is now off-limits to Vladimir Putin? After Crimea, can a Russian speaker make a phone call from anywhere in the world and dispatch the Russian army to liberate him or her? A perspective now from two neighbors of Russia, the Baltic nation of Latvia, also once part of the Soviet Union. Andres Razins is Latvia's ambassador to the United States. Welcome, Ambassador.
Hi.
Ambassador Razins is in the Latvian capital of Riga, and with us from Tallinn, the Estonian capital, also a Baltic nation, is Umas Payet, the foreign minister of Estonia. Minister Payet, welcome.
Thank you.
To both of you, and I'll begin with you, Ambassador Razins, how has the Crimea annexation unsettled the Russian-speaking population in your own country, if at all?
I should begin by saying that definitely what's going on in Ukraine currently, it's not only the problem for the Baltic nations or our immediate neighborhood. It's a European problem in general. And definitely people are watching television, they're listening radio, reading newspapers. And of course, what's happening currently in Crimea, that makes people worried about the situation, about development. But I may say that, well, we are part, Latvia is part of European Union and NATO, and that makes quite a crucial difference.
Let's look at Estonia, Foreign Minister Umas Payet. What is it about the Baltic nations that make them really off limits to this kind of, saber-rattling and rhetoric from Vladimir Putin, who wants to protect Russians everywhere in the world, seemingly?
First, of course, I'm absolutely sure that most of Russians all around the world don't need any protection at all. But at the same time, this kind of rhetoric, of course, it changes the security environment of Europe, because if you look around in Europe, in most of European countries, there is Russian minority, and the size of Russian minority is clearly increasing. So that's why it is absolutely appropriate that the European Union, NATO, but all other international organizations as well, say it and will say clearly that this kind of rhetoric, this kind of approach or attitude should not belong to 21st century.
Vice President Joe Biden is in the Baltics attempting to reassure some of Russia's neighbors. So what are you looking for from the U.S. Vice President, Foreign Minister Payet?
Well, I guess the most important thing is that this partnership inside NATO, but also in our bilateral relations, works really well. That everyone in NATO, for example, understands clearly that the security environment in Europe has been changed because of Russian aggression in Ukraine. And we all together, of course, have to do everything to decrease the possible risk level, and also then to speak about concrete things like strengthening of air policing mission of NATO in the Baltic states, which already also happened thanks also to U.S. government, so that all these kind of elements which will respond to changed elements of security environment of Europe.
That's Umis Payet, the foreign minister of Estonia. Mr. Foreign Minister, stay with us for a moment. We're also speaking with Andres Rozdins, who's Latvia's ambassador to the United States. The foreign minister of Estonia said it, the collective defense, that's the key word, the operative phrase in the NATO alliance. Is it the nation of Latvia's position that the U.S. and the West and NATO should stop the annexation of Crimea by even military means, or let it slide with the idea that military means will be required if something should happen in the Baltics?
Well, I must say that I think currently nobody speaks about military means. Definitely, we strongly believe that still there is a chance for a diplomatic solution. Of course, nobody wants to escalate the situation, but definitely Ukraine needs very strong backing currently because of this Russian aggression in Ukraine.
All right, I'm going to push both of you. I have to. The West did not roll back Russian rhetoric in Georgia, in Abkhazia, in other parts of former Soviet republics. There may be strong messages and sanctions, but nobody expects this annexation to be reversed. You're next. The Baltics are next. What is the constraint on Vladimir Putin in doing this anywhere else at this point? Ambassador Rozdins?
Well, I cannot agree with you that we are the next. I think nobody really knows what's in the mind of Russian government, current Russian government. What matters currently really is to take measures that makes such kind of endeavors in future simply impossible. And I should stress that definitely Latvia is part of NATO, and we strongly believe in a collective defense system. So in a way, I think there is quite a clear difference, and I would like just to say that. But of course, people in Latvia are concerned.
Final thoughts, Foreign Minister of Estonia, Umis Payet.
Well, I also completely agree that it is, how to say, not appropriate to speak that Baltic states will be next, because there is very clear difference between Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania on the one hand and Ukraine on the other, that we are members of NATO and there is the principle of collective defense, and also Russians know it very well. But at the moment, Russian leadership tries to get full political and economic influence over Ukraine. All international community, as they showed already in UN Security Council last Saturday, should be very firm to say what it is all about, and also to be ready for measures, as already US and EU here made first steps, because otherwise this conflict will still not de-escalate, but escalate.
Umis Payet is the foreign minister of the nation of Estonia, and Andres Rozdins is Latvia's ambassador to the United States. Gentlemen, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
By land or by sea, the search for Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 is right now taking place on both, as this unprecedented aviation mystery deepens. If there is a consensus among the experts we have spoken with on this program, it is that whatever the motives and scenario that caused the plane's radar transmissions and communications to be deliberately shut off and its course diverted, it probably ended up in the water. That's the most likely place a plane of that size could vanish, as we know, without a trace. At least that's where we stand right now. Mike Purcell is a principal engineer in applied ocean physics at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. Mike, welcome.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
You have expertise on Air France Flight 447, which was known to have gone into the North Atlantic, but you still had to find it. What are the surface issues for finding a plane and the sort of seabed issues in terms of finding something the size of a jetliner?
Well, I think to start out, it's a big project. It's a big effort. It involves a lot of people. Each day, you can only cover a small amount of area relative to the searches that are going on at this time from airplanes. Once we get the underwater vehicles in the water, they're searching about 25 square miles a day. In the case of the Air France search, there was a search area of 5,000 square miles. So you can understand that it's going to take a long time, even when you have multiple vehicles doing the work.
What is the loss of a week, you know, searching in the wrong place for perhaps as long as a week, due to the distribution and dissipation of debris, evidence that something actually hit the water, that kind of thing?
Well, I think in the case of the Air France accident, the debris was moving about 10 miles a day. So every day it's moved further away from the original location. And that just makes, I think, the area harder to reduce when you go back to the exact search area. So it results in a larger underwater search area.
What are the maps like in that part of the world compared with the North Atlantic? Are there well-mapped parts of the bottom of the ocean and poorly mapped parts?
I think that's true. There are some areas where the seafloor is pretty flat. There's other areas where it's pretty rugged. In the case of the Air France search, the terrain in that area was very rugged. It was very close to the Mid-Atlantic Ridge. I think that the type of terrain that's in the search area may impact the kind of assets, or at least what underwater assets are best used for the search.
We've already described this as a pretty unprecedented aviation mystery. You want to speculate as to what the first thing will be that indicates evidence of a crash, seaborne or otherwise? Will it be a piece of debris? Will it be a seat? Will it be a slick? What telltale sign will there be, do you think?
Well, I think at this point it's too late to think that you're going to find a slick, so it would be more likely a piece of floating debris from the plane.
Mike Purcell is principal engineer in applied ocean physics and engineering at the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. He was the chief of sea search operations for the mission that found Air France Flight 447 back in 2011. Mike, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Let's go big picture right now. If the universe began as an infinitely tiny exploding speck 14 billion years ago, why does it still hang together so uniformly? The universe is a pretty smooth place, far more symmetric whenever you look into the sky than you would expect from the results of a big brutal explosion. This has been one of the great mysteries of the cosmos. What happened early on to create such a smooth universe? Einstein tackled this problem in his general theory of relativity, where he suggested that very early on after the Big Bang, all forces were unified. Later, scientists theorized that at this point, the universe must have gone through a massive instant of inflation, expansion at the speed of light, almost at the very beginnings of the Big Bang. Well, what would be the evidence of this inflation? Yesterday, a group of scientists at the Harvard Smithsonian Center for Astrophysics reported direct evidence for cosmic inflation in the form of gravity footprints from 13.8 billion-year-old waves. Clem Pryke joins us. He was part of the experimental cosmologist team making this announcement and discovery. Congratulations, Clem.
Thank you, John.
So what instruments did you use? And I understand you were looking in that kind of noise from the Big Bang that we've known about since the 50s, the cosmic microwave background or cosmic background microwave radiation?
That's right. So we used a very special radio telescope located at the National Science Foundation's South Pole Research Station, a telescope called BICEP 2. And this telescope measured with exquisite precision a small patch of sky and measured the polarization of the microwave background.
And looking in this old noise that we've understood for a while, you found a very distinct signal. You were predicting something reasonably distinct, but it really jumped out at you.
Right. So what we measured was the polarization of the microwave background. As you say, the microwave background itself has been known for some time. But we've been making increasingly precise measurements of the polarization. And in particular, we were looking for a kind of swirliness in the pattern of the polarization. And this is a very distinct evidence for gravitational waves propagating through the early universe.
And what does this tell us about the nature of gravity? That gravity is a wave. Gravity at one time didn't have particles. The Higgs boson didn't exist at this point. Mass, you know, all that stuff we've been talking about for years.
So, as you said, Einstein's theory of general relativity predicts the existence of gravitational waves. They've never been observed before. This is basically the first observation of gravitational waves, and they're very special gravitational waves in this case because these are gravitational waves, as you said, from the very first instant of creation, spawned in that inflation process.
And when we talk about inflation, how does the existence of the waves suggest that a trillionth of a second or so after the Big Bang, the entire universe at the speed of light expanded, really setting in motion everything we see today?
So actually, the expansion was effectively faster than the speed of light. That's the special property that it needs to have in order to produce the smoothness of the universe. So a subatomic speck of pre-existing space blew up to occupy a volume larger than the entire observable universe today. In that process, it injected gravitational waves into the fabric of space-time, which are propagating through it even today. But in fact, we see them with our telescope as they were at 400,000 years, kind of written into the pattern of the cosmic microwave background.
Talking with Clem Pryke, who's an experimental cosmologist at the University of Minnesota, co-leader of the BICEP 2 team that made the discovery of those gravitational waves. This is The Takeaway. So, Clem, you know, the waves that you were looking at from so long ago, they're different from the gravity today. Is that because in the time of the Big Bang, everything was more detectable because it was all crunched in together, and we don't see gravity waves today because everything's so dissipated?
Well, in fact, there are scientists today that are trying to detect gravity waves here on Earth, but these would be gravity waves coming from relatively nearby and recent events in our universe, like the merger of black holes or neutron stars. So, in fact, and they will probably succeed in the relatively near future, but these gravity waves that we are seeing were incredibly powerful because they were injected in that first instant of creation. And so these are special, so-called primordial gravitational waves.
So I'm trying to get a visual here. I know that's impossible, and I know it probably annoys you that I'm trying to do this. But so the Big Bang happens. There's this opening up of this singularity on some level. Is it the case that basically your discovery tells us that the first force, the first, energy was gravity energy that was able to move stuff around?
Well, I mean, as you alluded to, in these at this very high energy scale at this very early time, the forces of nature are believed to be unified together, all four forces. And we don't know how to do that with current physics theory. So on the one hand, there's Einstein's theory of general relativity, which is the best theory of gravity that we have. And on the other hand, there's the electroweak theory. And quantum mechanics, essentially, and we don't know how to meld these together. So people have been questing for a so-called theory of everything for many decades, and this measurement may provide the insight that they need to make those next steps in physics theory.
So, Clem, what gives you more goosebumps, notwithstanding the idea that maybe you don't get goosebumps at all? Is it the idea that quantum mechanics and relativity would be merged in some level, or is it just purely witnessing something so close to the beginning of everything?
Well, I mean, I think it's incredible and just mind-blowing to have insight into the genesis of our universe, the creation of the entire universe in which we find ourselves. To understand physics at those fantastically high energy scales is, as a scientist, one of the ultimate goals. So, both things are incredibly exciting. This discovery is just mind-blowing. As you alluded to, it's the signal is a little stronger than was currently expected based on somewhat indirect measurements from other experiments. And so, it was just a hugely exciting thing for us to go on this, what we thought was possibly a wild goose chase, and actually find the goose.
A lot of goosebumps for Clem Pryke, who's an experimental cosmologist at the University of Minnesota, co-leader of the team that made the discovery of those gravity waves at the beginning of the Big Bang. Clem, thanks so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
What do you think about all this?
My name's Nelson, and I'm calling from Miami. Science explains the origins of the universe. Science differs from religion in that it is self-correcting, and nothing is sacred in science unless evidence and experimentation can validate it. In the words of the late Dr. Carl Sagan, science is more than just a body of knowledge. It's a way of thinking.
Tell us your way of thinking at 877-8-MY-TAKE or go to thetakeaway.org. Here's a theory about the universe from New York City. I'm really beginning to think that we are all very, very small and that the universe resides in the head of a pin in some giant's sewing kit. I like that. Novel. And then there's the ever-popular from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. I'm comfortable with God created the Earth. No need for all the scientific data. And then you've got Zach from Allenwood, New York, just taken with the majesty of it all. A lot of people I talk to feel overwhelmed and smaller than ever, but it makes me feel like I can't wait for first contact and to take my place as a member of the cosmic fraternal order. Fraternal order there, Zach? Hey, you know, we may end up with more than one or even more than two genders by the time we reach the galaxies. In any case, thinking of the discovery we talked about this hour of those gravity signals that show evidence of the 14-billion-year-old Big Bang, we asked all of you, how did these discoveries about the beginnings of the universe change your perception of the world and your existence?
Sean from San Antonio, and it's great to see humanity at the forefront, but it also raises the question, what other civilization in space is also asking the same questions we are? Where did we come from, and what was the beginning moment like?
Hi, this is Bruce Bennett from Plano, Texas. I'm just overwhelmed with the magnificent way God has created the universe. It's beyond human imagination.
Two Texans there with very different cosmologies, or maybe not so different. From Omaha, Nebraska, one of you says, the new scientific evidence comes at a time where, in my life, I'm growing more spiritual. My connection with God is stronger than ever. I'm having a hard time figuring out where science fits in with my religious ideals. The one thing I know, God created everything, including science. Or Stillwater, Oklahoma. No change for me. In the beginning, something exciting and unique and wonderful happened. Then everything else started happening and continues to happen. Do I need to understand it all? Nope. I'm along for the ride.
Yeah, this is Alan Crowder in Orlando, Florida. I'm a free thinker. God and his creation are far beyond the mankind's grasp and will always amaze me with the depth to which things are small as they are large. We have an enormously long way to go before we scratch the surface of his system.
Hi, this is Kevin Sutton from Dallas, Texas. Many people see this science as a threat to their religious beliefs. I see it as proof that a higher power is even greater and more sophisticated than the relatively young scriptures can possibly tell. What a great comfort to know that I am part of a plan so infinite in its possibilities.
One of you in Fort Myers, Florida, is on a journey, and I can't really tell if it's a pleasant one at this point. You write, my perceptions from scientific discoveries are taking me from agnosticism to atheism. From Paducah, Kentucky, it does not change me at all. I've always believed that belief in God and belief in the sciences are not mutually exclusive. But one of you out in Mountain View, California, seem to have his or her hands full right now. I've got a theory. I think there might be a recent newborn in the picture. You write, I'm more in awe of life and my own child. Your theories of everything, please, at 877-8-MY-TAKE. How did the discoveries about the earliest moments in the universe change your personal cosmological view? Does it give you more of a big bang, steady state? How you doing right now? You can join the conversation at thetakeaway.org or find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway, or you can just tweet us. That's very big bang-like. Little bang like at the takeaway. To Washington now, another Obama nominee, this time for Surgeon General, seems to be tanking. The Surgeon General nominee, Dr. Vivek Murthy, is facing political opposition for suggesting that gun violence is a national public health problem and for supporting stricter gun control laws and regulations. Joining us from the Capitol Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. What is the state of this nomination right now, Todd?
Foundering. The state of Vivek Murthy's nomination is pretty much dead at this point, although not officially. Senate leaders, their aides, saying at this point they're not scheduling a vote on Vivek Murthy. Now, why? John, you mentioned it in the intro, his statements on gun violence and public health. Politically, you guessed it, it's the NRA. As soon as Vivek Murthy was nominated. The NRA came out after him, writing letters to senators saying they were concerned about his radical views on gun violence and gun control. It led Vivek Murthy back at, in February to have to defend his views in November, have to defend his views in front of the Senate Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee. Listen.
I do not intend to use the Surgeon General's office as a bully pulpit for gun control. That is not going to be my priority. As we spoke about, my priority and focus is going to be on obesity prevention.
But didn't the Obama administration really create the problems for this designate, for this nominee, in the sense that because of the failure of the vote after Sandy Hook, the Newtown massacre, the president has really taken a public health approach on gun violence, using executive orders, using his own bully pulpit to make this linkage between public health and gun violence, and the Surgeon General designate walks right into the middle of it.
Well, it's multifactorial. Let's point out that, John, I don't think the White House made the linkage between gun violence and public health. The Centers for Disease Control and the public health academic industry has been doing it for decades. I did go back in the CDC archives and discovered that 32,163 injuries from firearms in 2011 and 32,000 deaths. It is the leading cause of death and injuries in men 15 to 34, injuries, homicide, and suicide. It is a public health issue. Whether our politics will digest it is another issue. It's multifactorial again, because don't forget also, Democrats in the Senate changed the filibuster rules over nominees. And ever since then, they thought that all their nominees were going to go through smoothly. There have been a couple of missteps. This is the second one in recent memory. Just a couple of weeks ago, the nominee to head the Civil Rights Division at the Justice Department tanked because of miscalculations by the White House there, too. There are other concerns for Republicans, I should say, beyond what the NRA thinks. Vivek Murthy is a young doctor. He's only 36. A lot of Republicans question his experience. He is a physician. He has started several groups about HIV/AIDS and medical technology, but he hasn't really led a public health organization before. And they're also concerned about his regular old politics. He also started a group called Doctors for America that was a pro-Obamacare doctors group, and he was very politically active on an area that Republicans are staunchly opposed to, which is, the Affordable Care Act.
Let's be clear. I mean, he was educated at Harvard and Yale. I mean, he certainly has credentials. I mean, the Surgeon General isn't exactly running the Centers for Disease Control or the National Institutes of Health. I mean, it's a more symbolic role. And back to the NRA, I'm just curious as to why this is a miscalculation of the White House. I mean, they said over the weekend, we're forced to get involved and voice our opposition. The NRA's opposition to equating public health policy and gun control is longstanding. Why did the administration believe the NRA wasn't going to go for this?
I'm not sure if they thought it through. I think part of the miscalculation here, it seems, is not only the NRA, but the NRA in an election year where several Democrats are running for tough re-elections in red states. And therein lies the problem. It's not just that the NRA said they were opposed. It's the NRA said, we're going to key vote this. We're going to score this vote. What does that mean? We're going to affect your NRA rating back home if you're running in Arkansas or Louisiana or Alaska. And we're going to tell all the voters back there and all those millions of NRA members that you damaged your rating by voting for a Surgeon General nominee who is pro-gun control. And a lot of Democrats, John, don't want that in a tough re-election year.
Sounds like this nomination is on its way to the morgue, Todd, to use a very bad metaphor. Todd Zwillig, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You bet.
The case of Brigadier General Jeffrey Sinclair will get a verdict this week, the end of an odyssey of success, pride, romance, violence, and concealment in what has been described as a culture of tolerance for sexual misconduct in the U.S. military. At the center of the case is an ambitious General Sinclair, a 27-year Army veteran, and the equally ambitious former mistress and ambitious Army captain. How does this case take us into the center of the military's culture at a moment when calls for reform on sexual abuse cases may make the Sinclair case the last of its kind in our era? Joining us is attorney, prosecutor, and former civilian consultant for the Army, Roger Caniff, who's been part of the prosecution team in numerous military sexual assault cases. Roger, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
How did the lead up to the Sinclair case put in play or depict what goes on in the military in these kinds of cases, the looking the other way, the chain of command vetoing attempts by attorneys to actually bring cases into court?
it's an extremely unusual case because the accused is such a high-ranking official. You know, misconduct at that level, or at least misconduct that's detected, is very, very rare. So I think it's difficult to compare the Sinclair case to almost any other case that's out there. I do think it's emblematic in terms of, you know, kind of a sense of entitlement that some higher ranking individuals have. And I think it's emblematic of the fact that, you know, somebody like Sinclair feels that he pretty much is all powerful and can get away with just about anything. And I'm sure he was quite surprised that the individual who accused him actually came forward and was willing to express anything to anyone.
The reluctance of his accuser, though, that's very comparable to the kinds of problems that occur all the time in the military in these sorts of cases.
Yes, that's true. And I think there are several reasons for that. I mean, I think generally in military culture, you don't have the sense of individualism that you have in the civilian world. So military personnel are expected to have unflagging enthusiasm. They're expected not to complain. They're expected to sort of keep a stiff upper lip. So even if a person feels wronged, even if they feel as if they've been sexually assaulted, it's not official, of course, but I think there's a sense that, hey, I really don't want to tell anybody about this because if I do, I'm going to be upsetting the apple cart. I'm going to be shaking things up. I'm going to be interrupting the mission. And I think there's just a sense of duty with a lot of military folks that they just don't feel that it's a good idea. They'd prefer to just sort of keep it inside and heal internally if they can.
Isn't it the case that a relationship between two officers violates regulations on some level? Doesn't that constitute fraternization?
Technically, fraternization is between an officer and an enlisted person. The real crime here was adultery because General Sinclair was married. So that was actually the issue. Adultery was the issue more than fraternization.
In this case, a turning point was reached, and suddenly a relationship gone bad was played out very, very publicly within the senior levels of the Pentagon. What sort of ripple effect does that have through the chain of command in terms of future behavior, be it generals, be it captains, be it people who are considering these kinds of relationships? Cases of lawyers who will take these kinds of cases in the future. What's the ripple effect?
Well, hopefully the ripple effect is a positive one in that, you know, individuals, particularly at Sinclair's level, will understand that that's just behavior that won't be tolerated. The military has always been very serious about punishing adultery, much more serious, obviously, than in the civilian world. And the rationale is that adultery within the ranks tears at the fabric that keeps the military cohesive and cooperative and moving forward. I think Sinclair is just a very toxic person who, you know, took advantage of a situation. He had a tremendous amount of power over this captain. I mean, the power relationship between a general officer and a young captain is really remarkable. And I know that there are plenty of people and plenty of people in the media who are sort of casting these characters as kind of equal players in a romance gone bad. I don't believe that to be the case. I am familiar with the prosecution team in this case, very familiar with them, actually. And I know that the core prosecution team has never wavered and very, very much believe the account that the alleged victim in this case gave. So, you know, in addition to just the wrongfulness of initiating an adulterous relationship with a young officer, which Sinclair clearly did, I believe that he also committed very, very serious crimes against her. So regardless of the fact that he won't stand convicted of those, I do hope that the ripple effect is one that discourages any kind of behavior anywhere near what he's done.
Well, he won't be convicted of those because he pleaded to lesser charges. How does
Correct.
The plea strategy here relate to that culture of tolerance within the Department of the Army or the military generally?
Well, I'm not sure how it relates to it. I mean, I think in this particular case, what I understand from the prosecution team is that the victim actually never wanted to see General Sinclair have to register as a sex offender, which he would have had to do had he pled to or been found guilty of any of the more serious sex charges that were before him. Plus, I think the process had just exhausted her to the point where when the prosecution team discussed with her, hey, we have the possibility of a plea here, what do you think? She was okay with it simply because she just needs to move on with her life. You know, how does that relate to how these cases play out? there's always pressure to resolve cases in the civilian world as well as the military world. And I also think that given this case, when you have an individual as high ranking as General Sinclair, I think there's even more pressure to resolve the case and just get it behind everybody. It's very, very difficult to try a senior officer. You need a military jury, which is called a panel. You need a panel of people who are at least of equal rank to him. It's just a logistical nightmare to try cases like this. So I think that there was probably a fair amount of desire on both sides to resolve the case somehow in a just way, and I think this is the way that was determined to be ultimately best for everybody in the end.
Finally, Roger, kind of a touchy subject. Are there lessons here for this captain, for a woman officer in her situation, and a possible fix that would ease disclosure for an accuser like this going forward?
I think the woman at the center of this case was victimized. That is simply my personal belief. I'm not speaking for the Army or for anybody else. I think that she has a valid complaint. I don't think justice was done in her case, and I think it's unfortunate. I don't blame anybody for it. I think the prosecution team did their level best. I think the defense did what it needed to do, what its duty. In terms of going forward, you know, clearly everyone is well advised in the military to avoid, you know, these kind of romantic situations. But a romantic situation and some unfortunate judgment is one thing, but being sexually victimized by a very powerful man is another.
Roger Caniff is attorney, prosecutor, and a former civilian consultant for the U.S. Army. Thanks so much, Roger.
Thank you, sir.
Here's a trivia question for the end of the hour. Name the 1970s Western TV series starring David Carradine and the actor who was passed over for the leading role in the show he pitched to the networks. The answers: Kung Fu, that's the show, and Bruce Lee, the actor. Bruce Lee's humiliations and setbacks as a struggling actor in Hollywood on his way to international superstardom are the source material for a new Broadway play written by Tony Award-winning playwright David Henry Hwang. It tells in story and in dramatic martial arts style choreography how Lee's brash approach to martial arts and his rejection of Asia's 20th century culture of submission made him a symbol of Asia's rise in the 21st century. The show is Kung Fu, and its star is a real Asian actor and martial artist, this time Cole Uribe. For writer Hwang, this was a project that took a very long time.
When I first started wanting to do a show about Bruce Lee, it was the early 90s. So I've been trying to pursue this for about 20 years. And at that point, I thought of Bruce Lee as a symbol of the rise of the new China. When I was a kid, China was considered poor and uneducated. And now, obviously, it's in a very different place. So that was the sort of symbolic thing that I wanted to explore in the early 90s. And then by the time we get to this version of it that I started to write about 2 or 3 years ago, I also wanted to look at Bruce Lee as a human being, because I feel like he has become such a recognizable icon, but nobody really knows how he became Bruce Lee. So in some sense, Kung Fu is Bruce Lee, the prequel. And I also wanted to explore Asian masculinity, which is generally pretty denigrated in the West and in our culture, and Bruce created this new archetype, the Asian male hero.
As we see in Cole Uribe's presentation and portrayal of Bruce Lee, he is so fearlessly ahead of his time in those early years. How biographically accurate is that, and how exciting is it in terms of drama to have somebody who absolutely just does not believe the prevailing conventional wisdom about anything?
I have marinated in Bruce Lee biographies now for about 20 years, and I think it's pretty accurate. I was really pleased that Linda, his widow, and Shannon, his daughter, came to our opening night and told me that they thought it was the most authentic telling of his story that they've seen. And I think it was incredibly exciting even now to see an Asian man who is completely assertive, completely confident, completely masculine, and has no apologies or illusions about that. In a way, it's like Muhammad Ali in the 60s, yes, being arrogant, but being arrogant because that was necessary in that time period and social system.
But I don't get the sense that Muhammad Ali was as alone as I think Bruce Lee often was, and as you portray him in this show. What do you think that was like for him and as a complication for your portrayal?
I agree with you that Bruce was iconoclastic in a way that was, you know, pretty unprecedented at that time. I mean, certainly there is a history in China of great leaders and heroes and assertive people and everything. But the idea of an Asian man in the West trying to put forth that kind of persona, yeah, he was pretty much on his own.
You really come at this mythology in American culture about Asians and martial arts that there's always some kind of wise old Yoda-ish sensei character. And the relationship of Bruce Lee and his father is a very complicated relationship that goes up and down. Father is authority at one moment, not so much at the next moment. How difficult was that for you?
Bruce, biographically, did have a very tumultuous relationship with his father. So I was building on the fact that his father kind of, in essence, kicked him out of Hong Kong at a certain point because he was a delinquent. He gave him $15 and he said, you know, come back for my funeral. And yet, his father ends up transmitting a lot of information that Bruce uses later in life to become the star that he becomes. So it is a complicated relationship, and I think it's true of a lot of father-sons or, you know, parent-child relationships that you get the good and the bad. And then later in the play, we see Bruce with his own son trying to transmit both good and bad and working through that.
Did he get closure in understanding his relationship with his father?
Well, I believe that he had to accept things that were associated with his dad in order to become the success that he became. He had to accept coming back to Hong Kong. He had to accept the techniques that he'd learned from his father as part of the general physical vocabulary that goes into martial arts. I think if he hadn't done that, he wouldn't have been able to make the pictures that he did.
The line, it's stupid to fight boards because boards can't fight back, referring to the, you know, spectacle of karate,
right,
which was very much part of popular culture in the 60s and 70s in the United States. Did you feel that? That, you know, going on the Johnny Carson show and breaking a bunch of boards with martial arts was an insult and a misapprehension of what martial arts was all about?
At the time, I don't know that I had that much knowledge of martial arts. I probably, just like anybody else, thought it was pretty cool that, you know, he could break a board. And even though Bruce didn't like stunts like that, he was also a showman, you know, and he was in Hollywood. And so he recognized that those things were useful and sometimes did them, though they might have been somewhat distasteful.
How tempted were you to explore or maybe expand the potential of Bruce Lee as a character, you know, who's almost, you know, messianic? I mean, he dies the same age practically as, you know, Jesus Christ. You know, he has this quality coming from Seattle like Jimi Hendrix, you know, but being one in a million, not part of some movement.
I think that there is a certain reverence that people can take towards Bruce Lee now, many decades after his death.
And express very openly.
Yeah, and, you know, even you have the situation with, I believe it's Serbo-Croatia, where there's a village and they were trying to erect a statue to somebody they could all agree on, and they erected a statue of Bruce Lee. So he has taken on that quality. My approach was to try to introduce him as a human being because I feel like the icon we all associate with now. But if the show is successful, it means that you go in thinking of him as iconic and as some sort of Superman, and you come out knowing that he was a human being.
And how have audiences responded to this show? Have you had Asian Americans say, you make too much of Bruce Lee, or this is the story we exactly want to hear? How empowering do you think this story has been to the people who've seen it?
The feedback that I've gotten from audiences is overwhelmingly positive, and people seem to feel very excited to see a piece about Bruce Lee that, of course, has this much kind of great martial arts and great movement and big dance numbers, but also makes him human. And, you know, some Asian Americans have said to me, oh, well, you know, we don't think that Bruce Lee had the same sort of problems that we do because we just think of him as this hero. And the show is a lot about his struggle and how some of these struggles are still very prevalent today.
David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
David Henry Hwang is the Tony Award-winning playwright of M. Butterfly, as well as Yellowface, Chinglish, and the new play about Bruce Lee, the man before he became the legend. The play is called Kung Fu. We'll end on the Big Bang and the big old universe. How does it make you feel that humans can detect something that happened at the moment of the universe's creation? From wise Bruce in Lindenhurst, New York, there is no inherent meaning to life, only the meaning or purpose I create. Life is simple, but not always easy. No human will ever understand all the laws of science. It is such a miracle to be alive at all, and especially now. Thank you, Grasshopper. Give us your take. 877-8-MY-TAKE. Check us out at thetakeaway.org. Leave us your comment. Tweet us at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.